From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a recent evening on Fox News when commentator Tucker Carlson unleashed a broadside against American diversity. He told his 3.2 million viewers, quote, "Diversity is our strength, is our new national motto. But what exactly does it mean? Nobody ever bothers to explain what it means. Is it true? The less we have in common, the stronger we are? Is a marriage stronger when spouses have radically different beliefs? Are you closer to your kids when you share no common points of reference? Do you speak the same language as your best friend? These are important questions. We should have talked through this ahead of time, but somehow we didn't." End quote. And Congressman Kevin McCarthy of California made similar comments. McCarthy said, quote, "It is not our differences that make us stronger. It is our unity despite our diversity," end quote. The congressman said that our country is stronger when everyone can speak the same language and aligns with the same values. And so a question, or a series of questions for you this hour. What do you think about diversity in the United States? Why has it become such a polarizing topic during political campaigns? What is cultural competency? How can we understand it? And who gets to decide which cultures, which sets of values are dominant, are, quote, better than others? The Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester is welcoming Dr. Ed Nichols next week. Nichols is a clinical psychologist who has been writing and teaching for years about axiology, cultural competency, values, belief systems, and more. But before he comes to Rochester, we're glad he's made the time for us. He's on the line with us. And Dr. Nichols, welcome. Nice to have you. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you. I want to thank you for inviting me to be a part of your program.
Well, we're grateful to have you, and you can thank Kit Miller, of course, who is the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester, and it's nice to have you back with us, Kit. Thank you.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
And also with us here is Dr. Kristen Hocker, who is co-specialty director in the Healthcare Management Program at the University of Rochester School of Nursing, also a board member for the Gandhi Institute. Welcome to you, Dr. Hocker.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to mention that if you want to attend a special event with Dr. Edward Nichols, that is next Thursday. That's 8 days from today, October 24th, starting at 5:30. Kit Miller, what do you want the community to know about that?
We want the community to know that we set, this is a fundraiser for the Gandhi Institute, but we set our prices very low to increase inclusivity. So we've got special rates for senior citizens and students are free. We're going to have some food from a Caribbean Heritage Restaurant also that we had underwritten. So we really want to make this a community event where people can come together, break some bread, and learn with one another with an elder whose work, excuse me, Dr. Nichols, for calling you an elder. I hope you don't mind.
Well, I am that.
So with an elder whose work has been really important to us in our understanding of how to get to the heart of dealing with issues of racism as a structure, and how do we do that in a way that holds mercy and insight.
And so Kit always tells me, you know, talk to the other guests. You know, Kit's very humble herself. So I'm just going to put you on the spot for one more minute, and then I promise I'll deflect to the rest.
Ignore me.
You and the Institute really were eager to bring in Dr. Nichols to hear the message. Specifically, why? Tell me about what you're so interested in hearing and what you want the audience that night next Thursday the 24th to hear.
My experience of Dr. Nichols' work thus far, which I'm excited to expand on when we have a chance to meet him live and in person next week for the first time, is two things. One is that the framework that he offered and developed for me really holds a lot of mercy and insight into why we are different from one another in ways that actually help to build understanding rather than create defensiveness. That's one. And then the other is that the model also helps to really look at the deeper narratives of why we are the way we are that's inherited generationally. And I think that that's critical because the mindsets that we have are at the heart of the systems that we've created. So if we don't understand those things, the chances of us being able to create positive change, I believe, is a lot lower. So I'm excited from someone who's interested in understanding systems and how to do our best job of changing systems. I think Dr. Nichols' work really is at the heart of a lot of that.
Well, I don't know if Dr. Nichols knows that Dr. Hocker has been turning to his work for quite a while now. So tell me about what you do in regards to Dr. Nichols' work and how you use that.
So I teach adjunct at the Warner School of Education. And I teach a class called Race, Class, Gender, and Disability in American Education. So I use Bruce Jones and Dr. Nichols' book, Cultural Competence in America's Schools, Leadership, Engagement, and Understanding, as one of my major texts throughout that course. And then currently I've also added Dr. Bettina Love's We Want to Do More Than Survive. So what is great about using these two texts, in addition to the other scholarship that the students engage in, is that Dr. Nichols and Bruce Jones set up a magnificent framework, as Kit outlined, this notion of axiological practice, the framework of cultural competence that for me feels and nestles more like cultural humility, in that it entails self-reflection, the examination of power balances within systems, and then also holds the systems accountable for implementing the change. And then the other dynamic within this text is that they also create the framework for self-reflection, but then also a notion of ecosystemic leadership, that when you're engaging within this self-practice of understanding yourself in relationship to your cultural understanding, understanding the other in the fullness of their cultural understanding, then the praxis is going, how do I then start to shape the systems in which we all inhabit, embody, and can function with all of our funds of knowledge participating in that system? And so it really takes students on a very, very different journey from the way in which they understand schooling and education to occur. I think some students are seeing it replicated. They are seeing these questions, these dynamics, these frameworks being applied. So it's just a great way to set up the foundation of the class and then dig into each of these elements of, as Kit said, why these differences exist, what's the fullness, the context, the historical context, and then how do they also shape these mindsets that have informed our systems for way too long.
Well, there's a term that we've heard twice now, and listeners, if you're not familiar with it, I'll ask Dr. Nichols to explain the term axiology first. Go ahead, Dr. Nichols.
Okay, good afternoon. In classical philosophy, there are many disciplines, and metaphysics is one discipline, ethics is another, and axiology is another discipline within classical philosophy. Axiology is the study of values and value systems. So if you're talking about axiology, the way I approach being a culturally competent person, that is, to understand self and others and see it all as equitable rather than one is great, one is poor, one is bad, one is all these different differentiations that one might make. You see each individual and their referent to their cultural reference through their value system. So let me show you how value systems develop. Of the ethnic groups in the United States and throughout the world, the youngest of the ethnic groups is the European. And that is because you only start your major civilization in Europe after the end of the last ice age, which was about 20,000, maybe 25,000 years ago. Other countries have existed with civilizations earlier than that. For an example, there are cities in Korea that are 30,000 years old. So when you look to see a group of people coming out of Africa and going into Europe, places like Germany, Switzerland, up in that area, what was necessary for them to be alive next spring? That's what I call, in every culture, there were certain things that were necessary in order for you to survive and thrive. So if we look to see what was necessary for Europeans to survive and thrive, then out of that becomes behaviors that they still transmit genetically through epigenetics to today. So let me give you one example. You live in Rochester, so it won't be very frightening for you as an example, but in Rochester, you have a very short growing season, but you have 9 months in which you can grow nothing in all practicality. So you have to plan for the months that you can grow something and have it sustain you for the months in which you can grow absolutely nothing. And you have to remember that in those places, snow covered the ground from September right on through practically to May of the next year. So if you are living there at that time, what behaviors will you develop that you carry, your generations now still carry, in order for you to have survived and thrived 9 months of winter? Well, one of the things is that attitudes have to change in terms of how people do a task. So if this is the week to plow, you can't say, I don't feel like plowing. You can't say, I'll put it off to next week. You have to plow now, because if you don't, you won't have enough food to survive and you'll die. So if the culture is imprinted with the idea that when there's a task to be done, you must do it and do it now in order to survive, then look at some other factors. If you don't do it, then there's death. So either you do it or there's death. Now, could you say, well, I'm just recovering from flu. I'm really very tired. I can't. Well, you don't have that option. So in this culture, even though you're partially ill, you don't have the option of not doing the task. And then in the timely way, you can't postpone it to next week or the week after. If it's to be done now, it's to be done now. And if you don't, you end up dead. Now, what is the carryover for that in our modern language? Well, we say if the task is due by 3 o'clock and you didn't complete it by 3 o'clock and you present it to your boss, he doesn't want to accept it because you missed the deadline. See how the collective unconscious memory brings these things back? You missed the deadline. So that means that after that point, for all practical purposes in that ancient society, you were dead. That was the reality of it. Now, if you put that into an office where people come from a different part of the world historically, where food was omnipresent for all year, then the urgency of something to survive and thrive, the urgencies are not the same. So what would you develop in another culture? Well, in Asian culture, considering that they were crossing the vast Mongolian desert and all those northern parts of the Uriel and so on up in that area, how did they manage to survive? A small group couldn't go across that area. In this country, we used to have a single covered wagon that would attempt to go from Missouri on up into Utah. Then finally, for safety, they began to put more wagons together in order to accomplish the same task. But there are many times that people struck out from Virginia to Ohio in just a single wagon. Well, in those areas, you could not survive with just a single group of people going, because it'd be long canyons in which you could walk down all the way to the end and you wouldn't be able to get out. You'd have to know that a collective group of people working together as a group, then that is the way that you survive. So for Europeans, the highest value, axiologically, is in the object. For the Asians, the highest value is in the cohesiveness of the group. Now, when you go to the mother source of all humanity, into Africa, food is omnipresent, the temperature is pleasant, everything that you need or want is right there all the time. So the focus is not on tasks as much as it is, how do I get along with the other person? How does one have a relationship with another person? Because I'm not going to be traveling miles and miles and miles through the vast deserts of Asia. I'm not going to be trying to survive in the ice and snow of Northern Europe. Everything is here. So then what is the top value? The top value is the relationship, how people get along with each other. And that's the focus. So now once you understand these things, you're getting closer to what I call the essence of ethnic difference. That is, in our very essence, there are ethnic differences that now we know. You see, I used to rely on Carl Gustav Jung and his collective unconscious memory to say how these things were transmitted to our society, like the deadline. Those are collective unconscious memories. But today, I've lived long enough that we have epigenetic data that tells us that certain cultural factors are transmitted through the genes, and that's how we live with them even today.
Okay. I'm absorbing as best I can lesson one from Dr. Nichols. And so let me then follow up and say, if you read about the way people respond to Dr. Nichols' work, you've got plenty of people like Dr. Hocker who take that work, take it into the classroom. You have some who probably more identify with what I mentioned in the introduction of the program, which is a feeling like, well, if we distill values to, well, for European or Euro-Americans, the highest value lies in the object or the acquisition of the object, that sounds to me like Dr. Nichols is just saying, well, we're materialistic, as opposed to saying, no, historically, there is a reason in the culture for more of an emphasis on deadline, on the need to get things done in a timely fashion. It might manifest in our modern society as an obsession with work, of not taking vacation, of getting things done now, of meeting those deadlines and penalizing people who do not, whereas different cultures have different ways of approaching it. And that I certainly understand that framework. Dr. Nichols, I wonder if you think over time globalization will make it such that those differences are more sort of rounded at the edges and not so severe, and we develop more of sort of a singular culture. In other words, globalization, travel, mixing of different cultures, even changes in climate, or are we so far along in the development of these cultures that those traits will stay, if that question is fair?
Okay. Let's examine that and see how it works. Recently, you had, do these traits stay with you and survive? My answer is yes. Your trait will stay with you. Let's talk about globalization. The point that I make is that the United States is multi-ethnic, pluralistic, and linguistically diverse. So all of the cultures that are outside of the United States, we represent in the United States. We have people from every single place in the world here in the United States. And because we have every ethnic group, every nationality represented in this country, if we look at those values that each group brings and then have you to interact with people outside of the United States that share the same value, same way of thinking, then we as the United States have a head start on the commerce of the globalization. The problem has been we have not been willing to unite. So let's see some of the, from the organizational psychology, OD work that I do. Scott is an author there at the University of Michigan, and he has told us very clearly that homogeneous groups, that would be all white males, are not as productive or creative as heterogeneous groups, which means men, women, different ethnic groups, and so on. So if that is a truth, a variable that we can really look at, then the reality is we have in this country all the people that can make the heterogeneous group. The problem has been we have been unwilling to be inclusive, to have equity, diversity, and inclusion. And because we've been unwilling to do that, we are not in real effort toward dealing with the competition of the world outside.
No, but let me interject and say, on the subject of inclusion, interestingly enough, the first time a listener of this program directed me to Dr. Nichols' work, it was on this philosophical aspect of culture paradigm. And the person who sent me the chart is a white nationalist who said, I agree with Dr. Nichols. And because of that historical development of culture and differences of values and acquisition of knowledge, that the best thing to do would be to draw those boundaries as best we can and stay in our own turf. That is literally what this listener said.
Okay.
And Dr. Nichols, essentially what he's saying is, when you have a culture that is dominant in a place, it becomes too difficult for other cultures to exist because they will be penalized for those natural differences that are developed for the reasons that you describe, and therefore multiculturalism becomes dangerous or a problem. And I'd like you to address that because as much okay. as it seems obvious to me, you are the scholar. So please.
Okay. Now, the white nationalist that sent you that information is thinking in terms of one group being superior to another. And when you have one group thinking it's superior to another, then that's the conflict. For an example, do you think that the Chinese government thinks or feels in any way that Western powers are superior to China? Not at all. Because they are, if you look at the last communist conference that was held, the head of the Chinese government said, this is our plan for 2050. And they're working toward their plan of 2050. I live here in Washington, D.C. We have only passed a continuing resolution for 2019. 2019 is almost over, and we're still passing continuing resolutions. Now, suppose you are a bureau chief here in Washington, D.C. How can you plan for the next year, any kind of program that goes beyond 1 year? You can't do futuristic planning. So what I'm sharing with you is that each ethnic group feels within themselves that they are indeed. They can say they're superior or what have you. But the advantage that we have in this country is to realize that you have people from each ethnic group that has demonstrated superiority as in one group or another. So let's take the people that let's get away from the idea that only one group is superior. That's the fault. And the reason for that is the process of socialization. If you were to look at the work that was done during the Apollo and all these different things, you find a black woman in there who was the chief mathematician. Now, when people see that in a movie, they don't want to believe it. Now, why do they not want to believe it? They don't want to believe it because the assumption through socialization on radio and television and so on has been that blacks don't have the competence to do that, or they don't have math skills. When you look at another mathematician, he was the one that gave us the third dimension. He was the one, when you look at television screens, everything was always flat. And with a math model, he's a graduate from a historical black college, he produces the structure that's necessary to give you three-dimensional thinking and rotating of objects on television. But does anybody know who he was or that he was black? You see, so it is when we socialize people and we leave other people out of the equation, then, of course, you come to the idea that only one group is the most brilliant group in the world.
Okay. Dr. Hocker, I know you've been following this work for a long time. Can you add to that your thoughts on engaging with this work and thinking about these ways that cultural humility, you know, is maybe an idea that we need to keep in mind when we think about differences in culture, but what is different inherently, I'm not a scientist, but I wonder if naturally, we might assume that our own ways of doing things are better in culture humility, how you see it.
Mm. So, yeah, there's so much to dive into. As I was listening to Dr. Nichols, I actually flipped to a page that I had, dog-eared? And I had highlighted this passage again, talking about ecosystemic leadership for cultural competence. And one of the last lines, it says, just this contemplative question and thinking about educational leaders. And it says, how do I engage in leadership that acknowledges the significance of recognizing that recognizes the interdependence of people who comprise a given neighborhood and or a community while co-concurrently engaging in action that reflects an authentic recognition and empathy toward people who come from diverse cultural backgrounds and histories that may differ from my own. And I think when I'm listening to Dr. Nichols talk about the idea of socialization, that's really my starting point in my classes. Is I talk about specifically, and one of the things I try to do is not shy away from, we got to talk about racism, right, in this country, as well as other, you know, isms and schisms, right, not to dismiss them, but we don't confront racism in our society. I say it's a conversation that people much rather have, you know, they much rather play in traffic in the street than really engage in it and really confront the notion of this gap or fissure that's occurred due to this idea of supremacy that has been embedded within our systems, right? So, you know, you could start with or frame it within why was genocide of indigenous people, of Native American people across our country even a thing? Why was enslavement even a thing? You can start with those dynamic questions, but get underneath the idea of what did they do on a relationship basis? What had to be the underlying thinking underneath that, that said that this is okay to do to other human beings, that vastly differs from an understanding of interdependence. Interdependence means that I sit here among you as one of you. And that entices a very deep empathy. That means I don't have to be of the same origin, of the same worldview, of the same perspective, neighborhood, but I'm still of you. And that's not dismissing the fact that we're all human beings and, right, that type of thing, because that can get, like, almost to the point where it renders people invisible. But that means that I'm going to start getting really curious about who you are in this environment. What's your space? What's your understanding? What's your worldview? What's your perspective? Not so that I can dismiss it, but maybe so that I can understand it from a different perspective. I can understand it from your truth. And I think that's where it starts with cultural humility. It means that I also have to be very solid in understanding of my own truth. I have to understand my own stories, my own histories, and have them as that foundation for where's the continuity in our stories. And I think that's where, like, one of the ways that that can be done is when you hear people rail against the idea that Black history stands on its own, as opposed to when Dr. Nichols alludes to the scientists, the Black scientists that have contributed to the American experience. And so where does that become encapsulated of this is our American history, but it has a distinction for Black people, African American people, because of the way in which we have not been visible within those histories. And that starts to shift our paradigm, shifts our context. And that's, I'll go back to cultural humility, the way in which it's very similar to this cultural competence framework in the Jones and Nichols text is that it starts with our self-reflection, understanding our stories, but it's lifelong learning. So competence, the way in which cultural humility takes a different leg from competence is that it unpacks the understanding of competence as an end goal, as humility is kind of this ongoing question and curiosity and way in which I can do my own continued investigation and understanding of stories.
So it, like, moves it from static to process language, kind of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the second is recognizing and challenging power imbalances. And so that interdependence means that if I'm noticing that other people are hurt, if I'm noticing that other people are being treated unjust, my voice enters into that call for where change needs to happen. I'm not waiting for the person hurt to say it. meaning, you know, if they're not at the table and if they're not, you know, speaking up. I mean, we have balanced that. You know, I don't charge in and just say I'm the voice of, you know, that we're having, you know, some sort of savior notion. But it means I'm contributing or backing up or saying in other spaces and encouraging that if equity is really to occur and it's what we value and inclusivity is really what we value, then I'm also going to champion that too, right? And then the last is the institutional accountability. So yes, you want the individuals on the ground, right, to raise their voice, but the institutions have to be able to come together and say, how do we want to be in the world? How do we want to be to our employees? How do we want to be in educational settings? How do we want to be to our students? All students. And do we understand what that means to be all students? And that's challenging because you hear people go, but what about this student? What about this student? What about this student? Great. Continue that curiosity. And then if that's not where you're meeting, then what do you do to start unpacking that strategy to say, okay, what are the needs? How do we understand the needs? Can we develop them now? Do we work towards that? Does that become a part of our ongoing strategy? So that's where the institution starts becoming culpable into being self-reflective, being lifelong learners, being lifelong strategists, and understanding where do their power balances exist so that they can reshape themselves in that notion of interdependence, and being spaces and places where students in education settings can survive, not as Dr. Patina Love so eloquently says, do more than just survive, do more than just get through day by day, but really thrive, really become the what do I want to say, vibrant citizens of this great democracy, right? We want that vibrancy. We want our communities to have that same vibrancy. So that's where I see it. I don't know if I just rambled or not, but that's where I see it all come together, and that's what I seek to encourage in our class discussions, using this text, using these frameworks, to investigate yourself, to understand your institutions, and how do we start driving the institutions to incorporate that praxis in a true equitable fashion, not just the design or the surface of equity, but really investing in equity.
Okay, Kit, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was just listening, as I was listening to you, Chris, and I was thinking about that actually there's a fair few number of stories from the New Testament that call for cultural humility. Like I think about all the number of times, at least of a couple stories that I know of where the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan, that back in the day, you know, when the New Testament stories were being written, I mean, the Samaritan was the quintessential other. So again and again, you know, like in the stories and that the apostles related that Jesus told people to do was to like embrace the Samaritan because they were often actually sometimes the person who showed up with the most compassion and the most mercy in situations like, you know, the person that was left to the side of the road and it was literally the Good Samaritan that stopped and took care of them when the priest and others walked past them. So in my mind, when we think about like what is our root identity, even again, if you know, I'm calling on myself as a white person, if you're raised in a Christian environment, your own sort of religious text is calling for you to think about this in a deep way. And I know that for me, when I first encountered Dr. Nichols' work, it really helped to open up my thinking about, well, what does it mean to be white? When I learned about this idea from him around, you know, this object orientation, I actually prompted me to go for a visit to Ireland for the first time, which is where most of my folks are from, and really kind of take in a different way what it means, you know, to have my own racial identity work. So I think, you know, as I read and learn about how oftentimes it's white progressives and white progressive organizations that sometimes can do the most harm inadvertently in some of the work that's being done for social justice, that all of us have to hold ourselves accountable. We have to stay in a continual process of learning. And for me, again, Dr. Nichols' work has been so foundational in helping move that forward. I'm so grateful to you, Dr. Nichols.
But one more question for Kit, and I'm going to turn the rest of the discussion back to Dr. Nichols, who's coming to Rochester next week as a guest of the Gandhi Institute. Kit, when you first encountered his philosophical aspects of culture, sort of that framework that Dr. Nichols has created. And under the European Euro-American headline is that the values tend to be the highest value lying in the object or the acquisition of the object. What do you remember your first reaction being? Because, again, some people read that and they're offended, or they feel like they're being called materialistic, or they view it as some kind of a condemnation of values as opposed to an exploration of history. How did you view it?
For whatever reason, it landed in me as this makes sense. I mean, I'm five generations Rochester folk, both sides of my family, and they mostly all came over getting rid of the famine in Ireland, which was actually, you know, a politically generated phenomenon by England. We were actually, Ireland was actually not exporting food during the famine. So I guess for me, the idea that people move towards where they can have enough to eat is like foundational. And I don't have any direct memory of any of that, obviously. I didn't even have great-grandparents around telling me the stories of it. But it's so. But anyways, from my perspective, that makes lots of sense. If you grow up in a place like here, or in a place like, you know, Northern Europe, or in the British Isles, a lot of it, you had to get that seed in the ground, and you had to, you know, pull stuff up. And over generations, whoever was the best at doing that and hanging on to stuff and saving were the ones who were most likely to survive and pass that idea of being industrious down to their you know, next generation. And so over time, that would, of course, come to be seen as the most thrifty, hardworking way to live in the world. And it was seen as a virtuous way of living. And it makes a lot of sense, you know, to me. So I don't have a problem with it because it... But I'm happy to chat with anybody who does.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and talk to Dr. Ed Nichols, who's on the line with us, who is a clinical psychologist with an emphasis in the field of cultural competency, coming to Rochester as a guest next week of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. The special event with Dr. Edwin Nichols is next Thursday. That's October 24th. Starts at 5:30. At Five Star Bank Plaza on Chestnut Street. And if you want to jump online to the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester's website, ticket information, event information, it's all there, and they would love to see you there next week. Let's get that break, and we're right back on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Some feedback from listeners for Dr. Nichols now. Alex says, are we looking in the wrong places for commonality? As Americans, as an older white man, don't I have more in common with a black American woman when we both hold the same values of equality under the law, of equal opportunity, freedom of consciousness, etc., than I do with an older white communist, or than she might have with an African Marxist? We are diverse in appearance, but not in the values that we hold in common. Dr. Nichols, what do you say to that?
Okay. What I'm suggesting to you that axiology goes beyond political thinking. Political thinking is sort of a superficial thing that is outside. The real, what I'm suggesting to you in terms of axiology is something that is deeply rooted and seated in behavior patterns. Now, some people from Russia thought that communism would be the way to have a collective. That's an accidental. Some people think that capitalism is the way to do it. That's an accidental. But the idea of doing things in a timely way, storing, saving, and preparing for the future, is something that both systems have in common. Now, what I would like to do in the time that's remaining is I want to move from axiology to epistemology. Epistemology says how do you know, not what you know, but how do you go about knowing it? And that is the success of the United States over the rest of the world. We have people from every epistemological model active in the United States. If we give them the opportunity to produce without a hierarchy in terms of what is best and what is not, but when you come together, well, there are a couple things. Team membership is the unit of production for the 21st century. We used to have a vertical hierarchical system, and you had to please the person who was directly above you, and you got promoted. But that whole system collapsed in the 70s, and now we are in a horizontal and flat system. more people doing tasks and fewer supervisors over you. So, and the other part of it is that you don't stay in one job for your whole career. You will be on one team, they'll complete the task, the team will be dissolved, you'll go to another team, and if you don't have the skills to be placed on another team, in other words, you don't morph successfully from one process to the other, you'll be out of a job. Now, so what it is doing, it is again focusing on the object, if you will, in terms of the object becomes the task. That's what we have to do. But the breakdown that makes that even more compatible in the United States is we have people that solve problems differently. So the fact that you can approach a problem and can solve it differently says we have an opportunity to do things first and better than any single ethnic group outside the United States because we have everyone on the same team. Now, that's our success, that's our triumph, that's the 21st century if we get ahead. But it says that you have to be willing to accept, extract, and utilize my way of solving the problem. Now, let me give you an example. We have a situation in which third grade, 8-year-old boys, black boys, have the most difficulty from that point on in school. Before that, they're doing very well. But at this point, they begin to have difficulty. And that sort of starts that pipeline from school to prison. But when you break it down to find out exactly what is going on, is that there are two epistemologies, and the young boys have not been able to shift from one to the other and be successful at that point. Girls, black girls, all girls do it more rapidly. They make the choice. They can make that shift more rapidly. But let's give a specific. The teacher assigns a problem, all right? And when she assigns the problem, each person is to try to solve the problem. With a European set of children who are from the Greek philosopher Democritus, their thought process is things are parts that become the whole. And they approach the part, part A, part B, part C, part D, and then finally you get to the whole. Now, the African youth that is sitting right, African American is sitting right next to you, are holistic thinkers, and they look for the whole. They're looking for the big picture. Now, in looking for the whole, if the teacher is assigning part A, B, C, D, E, the child is thinking that A is a whole, B is a whole, C is a whole, D is a whole, and not seeing that there's a connection in terms of step one, step two, step three, step four to the connection. So he's not doing well in the class. But later on in the semester, he recognizes that these are parts to a whole. So now he has the big picture of what is being asked of him and starts to turn his homework in. Because he has not turned in homework with anything other than a D or an E or very poor up to this point, the teacher is suspicious in terms of how it, well, where did you get it? And of course, the first thing that comes to it, because of socialization, is that he must be cheating. And he says, I'm not cheating. Well, then the teacher says, well, explain to me how you got it. Well, at 8 years of age, in the third grade, he's not able to say, I used critical path analysis. Okay? So now when you examine it, there were seven steps. At the back of the teacher's handbook, it says there are seven steps to solve this problem. Okay. He does not use seven steps. He does step one, four, and seven. And she wants to know where is two, three, five, and six. He can't say that I use critical path analysis because he doesn't know about that construct. But he solved the problem. Now, let me take it to another level. And you can see where we're talking about things that we have to get rid of in this society. And one of them is implicit bias. Here in the Washington, D.C. area, we have Bethesda Chevy Chase High School, which is one of the best high schools around. And historically, it had a school district that included what is now west of Rock, east of Rock Creek Park, and there are a lot of apartment buildings, and children from lower socioeconomic levels are there. I mean, their parents work, but they don't have a lot of money. So this is one African young girl in high school, and they have calculus classes. And she happens to be the only girl in her specific calculus class, and she gets all the answers right all the time. Now, the teacher has an implicit bias, and the implicit bias is, one, sexist, that women really aren't that good at math, and two, Africans certainly couldn't know how to do math. Those are his two implicit biases. So he approaches her with those biases, trying to figure out how is it that you can do it? How is it you can do it? And she says, my father taught me. Now, come on, you just come out of Africa. You're just here. How could your father teach you calculus? There's another implicit bias. The reality is, she says, my father taught calculus in Senegal. He can't believe that this is possible. So he asks that the father come to the school. The father comes to the school, and he solves the problem with a different epistemological model, one with which the European system does not solve the problem in that same way. Now, instead of saying, because their answer is always correct, I don't know how you do it, but if our team is going to be producing products faster, then I will be willing to accept how you solve it. I don't need to know how you solve it, but I can accept that you solved it, and we can move on. No, he's not doing that. His remark was, if she does not solve the problem in the way that I say to solve it, she will fail the course. Now, how much time is it going to take her to unlearn her own system and relearn his system, and how many errors will she make trying to do all those multiple steps as opposed to what her father taught her, which is critical path analysis. So that's the waste of human potential, human knowledge that we have in our country. And that's what is costing us to be behind the eight ball in terms of globalization. But my theme is, let us all utilize our own epistemological model on the team and people willing to accept it, and we can beat anybody in the world. But if we don't do it, we will be a second or third class world power in international competition.
So, Dr. Hocker, that seems to be the one of the answers to, is diversity a strength? That's where we started this conversation, and as Dr. Nichols just described, that's one place where diversity very much can be a strength. Do you agree?
So what came up in my mind as I was listening to Dr. Nichols share that example about how two epistemological modules can either counter each other or they can supplement each other. And one, I was kind of giggling to myself because I've gone through my whole schooling thinking I was horrible at math and just always had a fear towards math. And I never looked at it as, how was it countering my own way of knowing? Because I didn't have that language. You know, you don't have that language when you're 8 years old. You don't have that language when you're 5 years old. You just know the teacher's yelling at you. You just know that you've failed a test. You just know that you're not succeeding the way in which the teacher or the administration is applying this idea of success. So it was bringing up a lot of my own stories of being a child in school. But the other thing I was thinking about was I was just listening to a story, actually watching a story on PBS NewsHour, and they were interviewing farmers in Iowa, I believe, and they were talking about how, like, just planting soybeans and corn as just these rotational crops that once, you know, they die, you harvest them in the fall and you have to till your ground in the winter. I'm not a farmer, so excuse me to any farmers if I'm getting the terminology wrong. But the idea that you just left your ground kind of barren during that winter was what farmers are currently recognizing, at least these white farmers, largely white farmers that they interviewed in Iowa, talking about how that's problematic, how that uses pesticides, and all these things that we're now seeing as leading to, right, this challenging climate change and everything. As opposed to what happens if you start planting other plants, right, in the ground during the winter season, and, right, so that they produce nitrogen. And the thing that bothered me was this is indigenous ways of knowing. This is indigenous epistemology, and so the whole notion of three sisters, right? How the plants supplement
beans,
and grow themselves.
Squash.
Right, exactly. So that's where you see, again, another epistemology has informed a counter epistemology, and how it can supplement each other as another way of knowing and another way of being able to do and support your goals.
Dr. Kristen Hocker is going to be introducing Dr. Ed Nichols at the event next Thursday, the 24th. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Oh, thank
afternoon.
You. It was a pleasure being here, and looking forward to meeting you, Dr. Nichols.
Dr. Nichols, and we'll see you in Rochester next Thursday, the 24th. Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome. Goodbye to Kit and to Dr. Law, and to you also, Mr. Dawson.
Well, thank you very much. Kit, thank you. Greatly
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you all.
John Andrus, engineering today. Gary Putup, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow.